Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is February the 19th. We are in Parshas Metsora on page 626. We're talking about the tzaras on a person's house. And we've discussed the process of what happens if it's discovered and then the Kohen rules on it, etc. And we're up to Pasuk Mem Vav 46. Is that correct?
That's what I have, but I have
okay. Okay. So we've discussed the tzaras on the house. We even mentioned that the reason why the Kohen tells the homeowner to remove all his items from the house is because if the tzaras is pronounced on the house, then the items in the house become tameh, even though they don't touch the tzaras, but they're in the same house, the same building as the tzaras stones, then the items become tameh. So what happens if a person walks into the house while it has tzaras? So the Torah says, V'haba el habayis kol yemei hiskiro so, anybody who enters the home as long as it's been locked up, meaning there's still tzaras in there, Yitma ad ha'arev, he becomes tameh until the evening. He contracts a tumah. It is a one-day tumah for walking into the house with tzaras. He will have to go to the mikvah, and he remains tameh until evening. He goes to the mikvah, and then when the sun goes down, then they become tohar. Now, this means to walk in and walk out. The next pasuk says, Vashochev babayis, one who sleeps in the house, yechabes es begadav. Not only does he become tameh, but his clothing becomes tameh. Va'ochel babayis, someone who eats in the house, yichabes es begadav, he also needs to wash his clothing, which means the clothing needs to be put in the mikvah. Now this.
Do they put any kind of sign?
Yeah, I would imagine they do. Yeah. Now I would imagine. I don't imagine the way that this is presented sounds like there's something specific about sleeping and about eating. But in truth, there is nothing specific about them. What the Torah is actually conveying, the way Chazal, the way our sages explain it, is that the second verse over here, the Mem Zayin 47, is actually describing a time frame. That if someone lingers in the home, then the tumah is worse. If a person walks in and walks out, then they become tameh, but their clothing does not become tameh. If they walk in and remain in the house for a period of time, then the clothing becomes tameh as well, which means that the level of tumah is a higher level of tumah. See, if a person becomes tameh, depending on their level of tumah, they either also make their clothing tameh or they don't make their clothing tameh. We're going to learn about this when we get to the next section of discussion here in Parshas Metsora, which is about Zav and Zava, etc., which we'll see about. We'll have an introduction to that tonight. But the different levels of tumah are going to have a hierarchy that the higher the level, the more that can happen. For the time being, I don't want to get into the specifics, although tonight, when we get to the introduction for the next section, we'll get more into the specifics. But it is a higher level of tumah if a person lingers in the home. Now, how long does one linger in the home in order for there to have the higher level of tumah? So that is the amount of time it takes to eat. The eating in the home here means if one lies down in the house for the amount of time that it would take to eat in the house, that is the amount of time that would give that person the higher level of tumah, and therefore their clothing will become tameh. Whereas if they walk in and walk out and do not linger there as long as it takes to eat a meal, it's not a meal as you'll see in a minute, but as long as it takes to eat, then only they would be tameh, but not their clothing. It doesn't matter what a person does in the home when they linger. They could linger lying down, they could linger sitting down, they could linger by getting on the treadmill and running. That's still lingering in the home. And if they linger in the home, the amount of time that it takes to eat, then they will contract the higher level of tumah. Lying down or sleeping is just an example. But it's any form of lingering in the home for this amount of time. Now, how much time is it? And how much eating is it? So the amount of eating is the amount of time what is called in the language of the Mishnayos, Kedei Achilas Pras, which means the amount of time it takes to eat a piece. A pras means a piece. It's referring to a half a loaf of bread. The amount of time it takes to eat half a loaf of bread, that is the amount of time that if a person lingers, they contract the higher level of tumah. But then the question is, how large is the loaf of bread? What kind of bread? Different types of bread take more to eat and less to eat. So the Gemara goes through all of this, and the conclusion is, it's a relatively easy loaf of bread to eat. It's also not a very large loaf of bread. The amount of time, as far as we're concerned, ranges depending on the various opinions in the poskim. The shortest time that, and you have a whole range of opinions, the shortest opinion is 2 minutes, the longest opinion is approximately 9 minutes. It ranges from 2 to 9 minutes. Now this is not relevant to us today with a house that has tsaras, but it is relevant to us for other things. So just before I apply it to other things, understand that what the Torah is saying is that if a person enters the home and walks out before that amount of time, whether it's 2 minutes, whether it's 5 minutes, whether it's 9 minutes, depending on what opinion you say, then they will become tummy, but not their clothing. However, if they walk in and they linger there for anywhere from 2 to 9 minutes, depending on the opinion that you hold, then their clothing will become tummy as well. Why is it relevant to us? Because this shear, this amount of time called kedei achilas pras, which literally means the time it takes to eat half a loaf of bread, which, as I said, there's a range of opinions what that is. That amount of time is significant in halacha in many ways. Mm-hmm. The most universal application of that is what? Okay, but that's true after blessing. But even more specifically,
matzah.
Then when you eat your kezias of matzah on the night of Pesach, you have to eat the kezias of matzah b'chidei achilas pras. In the amount of time it takes to eat this half a loaf of bread, obviously you're not eating half a loaf of bread on the night of Pesach, but it's the amount of time it would take to eat half a loaf of bread, that's the amount of time you have to eat the kezias of matzah. Now, the amount of a kezias of matzah is also contested. Mm-hmm. If you're using a machine matzah, the regular square machine matzah, so some say it's a half of a machine matzah would be a kezias. Some say it's a quarter of a machine matzah would be a kezias. Others say you have to eat a whole machine matzah. So let's for argument's sake say half of a machine matzah would be a kezias. Well, one could eat half a kezias of half a square matzah. One could eat that in a minute. One could eat it very, very quickly. One could also linger over that half of a matzah. One could eat it in 20 minutes. It could take to eat that half a matzah. So how much time do you have? You have to eat it within a certain amount of time in order to fulfill the mitzvah of eating a kezias on the night of Pesach. If you take too long to eat it, it's not considered eating a kezias. It's considered eating a mouthful here, a mouthful there, a morsel here, a morsel there. That's not called eating a kezias. To eat a kezias, it has to be combined. All those bites that you eat have to be combined into one eating, one sitting. How long is that? That is a kedei achilas pras. So those who are trying to be very stringent will eat a whole machine matzah in 2 minutes. And that would be the strictest of all opinions. However, one does not have to be that strict. One can eat half of a machine matzah in about 5 minutes would be a very reasonable opinion to use. Half of machine matzah in 5 minutes, that would be acceptable. In the hand matzahs, the hand matzahs are not a uniform size, although they're approximately the same size. Generally, a third of a hand matzah is equivalent to a half of a machine matzah, and that would be the same thing. A third of a machine matzah within approximately 5 minutes would be fulfilling one's mitzvah. Now, all this is speaking about a healthy person who does not have issues with digestion and issues with blood sugar and things like that. That's what we're talking about when I give these amounts. Anybody who has trouble with the eating of matzah, whether it is a digestive issue, whether it is more significantly a blood sugar issue, then of course they should ask their LOR, their local Orthodox rabbi, before consuming that much matzah in that amount of time. But that is the Kedei Achilas Pras. Another application of this time frame of Kedei Achilas Pras, as Dina just mentioned before, is the after bracha, which means that if a person eats a kezayis of something, whether it's an apple, whether it's a piece of cake, whether it's a pretzel, whatever it is, if a person eats a kezayis worth of that, then they not only make a bracha rishona, a beginning bracha, but they have to make an after bracha, either barei nefashos or ala mechia, or in case of bread, they have to bench. So that is also only true if the food is consumed within that amount of time, meaning a kezayis worth of the food is consumed in that amount of time. If a person nibbles on something, then they would not make an after bracha. So for example, if a person has a sucking candy, and a person eats 12 sucking candies over the course of the day, and if you add them all together, it's probably close to a kezayis, but it took them several hours to eat the 12 sucking candies, they would not recite an after bracha because they didn't have the kezayis within approximately 5 minutes, 2 to 9 minutes, depending on the opinion that you hold. So there would not be an after bracha. But if a person wolfs down something, or eats it, really you don't have to wolf it down, just eats it in a normal way, in a normal pace, then one would have to make an after bracha. So that amount of time is the same as we're saying over here, which is kedei achilas pras, which is approximately 5 minutes, something like that. That would be the amount of time that one, if they would eat a kezayis worth of food in that amount of time, then they would recite an after bracha. Yes?
So a practical question for Shabbos, when the bread is going around, is it best to eat, make sure you're eating a kezayis right then and there and not just take a bite because maybe you'll spread the bread out throughout the whole meal?
Okay, so there's two issues over there. One is that one may spread the bread out throughout the whole meal and then not really be required to make an after bracha, although some of the other foods you eat during the meal would actually contribute to the after bracha, even if it's not actually bread, because you eat bread-like foods as well throughout the meal. But that is an issue. The other issue is that it is considered to be optimal to eat, even if you intend to eat a lot of bread later on in the meal, it is optimal to have a kezayis within the first few minutes after you make the hamotzi. So it is best to have a kezayis with it. It doesn't mean you have to have a ton of challah, but it is best to have several bites of challah. Again, not you don't have to wolf it down, but within the first few minutes of your meal, to have several bites of challah in order to have that kezayis within the first few minutes. Yeah, that would be optimal.
I don't remember who the author is, but I have a book at home, I'm sure Judaic would know who wrote it, that shows pictures.
Yes, yes.
Of the kezayis. It's a very helpful book.
It is a very helpful book. Bear in mind, there are always other opinions, right? It is an opinion. It is a valid opinion, but it is an opinion. Don't be surprised if you're at somebody's house and you see a different opinion being used, because there are other opinions.
Right.
Yes.
This is a total logic question. What would propel somebody to go back in a house?
That's a great question.
We're going off these things of right. this and that. And the only thing, right. just don't go in the house.
Right. Yeah, you are right. House, you are right.
But even if it's your house, it had saras in it, why would you want to go
I
in
don't
it?
Know. Yeah. Well, maybe they didn't get the sign up yet. And somebody.
Okay, so.
Somebody, if it was an accident, right. it's one thing. But
knowingly, a person really shouldn't go in there. Now, it could be that when they cleared out the house, they forgot something.
Right, that's what I mean.
And then they went in to get it. You know, something like that.
I was thinking a kid's medicine, but.
Yeah, something like that. But you're right. Best would be to stay out of that house, right? You're right. Yes.
When they use the lashon of eating, does that include just eating something already prepared that they brought in, or is it actually cooking and then eating it?
The kedei achilas pras is the eating process. That's the amount of time to eat. Yes, you have a question?
So, Rabbi Pransky, so here we're talking about the amount that we're eating, whether we should say a bracha afterwards.
Yes.
What about the amount of time after you've eaten something?
That's a different discussion. After a person has eaten, and I'll answer this, but then we'll move on, because I don't want to get sidetracked with the after brachas, but if a person has eaten and has not, one should make the after bracha right away. That's what one should do in order not to forget. Certainly before they get up from the table, they should make the after bracha. In the event that one did not make the after bracha right away, they have a minimum of 72 minutes. That's a minimum. Now, in other words, if a person ate only one kezayis of food, they have 72 minutes before the time expires to make the after bracha. If a person ate more than that, a meal, for example, then they have until they are no longer feeling full from that meal, which could be several hours. Mm. Especially a Shabbos meal, it could be several days. it could be several hours before the time expires. So a person had their Shabbos meal, and then they didn't make an after bracha, and it's 2 hours later. It's 3 hours later, but they're still feeling full from the meal. They can still sit down and make the after bracha. But at the minimum, 72 minutes. Now, one last point about this is all eating. Drinking, Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, Shehakol Nivra.
Amen.
Drinking is different, because drinking, there are different opinions, there are two opinions, whether drinking follows the same rule, which means that if a person would drink, it's not a kezayit, it's a revius of drink. A revius of drink is three times a kezayit. So if a person would drink that amount of drink within approximately 5 minutes, then they would be required to make an after bracha. That is one opinion. But there is another opinion that says drinking is different because the normal way to drink is much faster than that. And therefore, one would have to drink the revius in the amount of time it normally takes to drink a revius, which is pretty quick, which is drinking a revius straight. So therefore, if one sips a drink, hot coffee, or if one, for argument's sake, is giving a class and they're sipping the drink as they go along in the class, one would not make an after bracha unless they drank approximately 3 to 4 ounces quickly at one time. So with drinks, one would have to drink it in a regular way to drink in order to be required to make an after bracha.
Does that go for wine also? It goes for wine also, yes.
So the just so you know, in this particular class, when I do often drink the water while speaking, so I do monitor what I'm doing. And if I don't drink that amount in one time, I don't make an after bracha. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I go back to my office, whatever's left in there, I drink in order to make the after bracha. But because I'm sipping it throughout the shiur, then it would not be required to make an after bracha. Yeah.
If one is not sure whether one has eaten a kezayis or drunk a revius, would it be better to err on the side of making a bracha or not making?
Not making a bracha. Okay. Well, the rule of thumb is suffik brachos lahakol. When we're not sure about a bracha, we do not make a bracha. Okay. Same would apply if a person forgot whether or not they made a bracha rishona, forgot whether they made a shahakol or not. They should not make another bracha because we are on the side of caution not to make a bracha. The only exception to this is if one ate bread and was satiated. If one ate bread and is full from eating the bread, then the obligation to bench is from the Torah, where all other brachos are from the Rabbanan, or Rabbinic. So if one ate bread and is satiated and one does not remember whether they bench or not, then they should bench. That's the only exception. So this is what happens with one who shouldn't have, but walked into the house. Then if they lingered that amount of time, then they will become a higher level of tumah, and their clothing will become tameh as well, and need to be put into the mikvah. Pasuk Mem Ches, verse 48. V'im bo yavo ha-kohen, if the kohen shall come, v'ra, and he sees, v'nei lo fasa ha-nega b'bayis, and he sees that the affliction did not spread through the house. Acharei hitoach es habayis, after the house was not totally dismantled, but after those stones were taken out and it was replastered, which really means over here that it didn't come back. That's really what the verse means. Even though it says it didn't spread, it really means it didn't come back. Then v'tihara kohen es habayis, the kohen will pronounce that the house is pure. Kinir pahanaga, for the affliction has been healed. It's gone away. So they are now, the house is fine. Now, what does one do in the purification process of the house? It's going to follow a similar system that we had with the purification of a person. He shall take to purify the house 2 birds, ve'etz erez, and some cedar wood, ushni solas, and red dyed wool, ve'ezov, and hyssop. V'shachata satzipor ha'echaz, he shall slaughter the 1 bird, el klicheres, into an earthenware utensil, amayim chayim, on water, Again, live water, which means water from a, right? It's up on the board. Water from a underground, an underground stream. V'lakachas ein tzo'erez, he shall take the cedar wood, v'es ha'izov, and the hyssop, v'es shniyat olas, and the red dyed wool, v'es ha'tzipor ha'chaya, and the live bird, v'tavalo sam b'dam ha'tzipor ha'shuchotah, he shall dip them in the blood of the slaughtered bird, u'v'amayim ha'chayim, and in the water, the blood and the water are mixed together, and you dip it into that mixture. And then sprinkle it on the house, or towards the house, seven times. This is in place of the person. The person we had, that it sprinkled on his hand seven times, here it is sprinkled towards the house seven times. And that he purifies the house, with the blood of the bird, and with the water from the stream, uva tzipora chayam, with the live bird, uva eitz ha'eres, and with the cedar wood, uva izov, and with the hyssop, uvishnia tolas, and with the red dyed wool. Vishilachas hatzipora chayam mechutz la'ir, and he shall send the live bird outside the city, el pnei asadeh, on the face of the field, v'chiper al habayis, it shall atone for the house, v'toher, and it is purified. So if you look on the board, the purification process that we had for a person, this is only the first few steps, that you take those items and you slaughter the bird, you dip everything in, you send away the bird. From here on in, then nothing else is done. Numbers 5, 6, 7, and 8 have to do with a person who is tameh. But here, there's nothing else to do. The house is purified, that's it, it's done. They can move back into the house, put everything back in the house, it's all good.
What does it mean to clean the house with the blood? I mean, scrubbing floors?
It doesn't mean to clean. It means to purify.
So it's just...
Yeah, clean is not... I would not have translated it as clean. I would say purify.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. So, now the Torah summarizes what we have learned over the past few chapters, really the past few weeks for us. Zos HaTorah, this is the law, L'chol nega ha-tzaras v'lanosek, for all tzaras, afflictions, and nesek. Nesek was the tzaras that was on the hair. Ulitzaras ha-begev v'la-bayis, and tzaras on clothing and on a house. V'la-seis v'la-sapachas v'la-behares. And four, these are three different types of afflictions, which are translated as seis, sapachas, and behares. L'horos, to rule, v'yom ha-tomei u'v'yom ha-tahar, on the impure day and on the pure day. And then the Torah concludes, Zos Tzaras HaTzaras, this is the law of Tzaras. We're going to end with one last point on Tzaras, which is on this last verse, L'horos b'yom ha-tameh u'v'yom ha-tahar, to rule on the impure day and on the pure day, that the simple meaning of that is that whichever day is pure and whichever day is impure, you wait 7 days, you count, etc. However, there is another point that our sages make over here, which is that there are days that the kohen does not rule on saras, and there are days that he does. Mm-hmm. Meaning that if a person calls the kohen to rule on his house or on his clothing or on his body, there are days that the kohen does not respond to the call and says that we'll look at this later.
Like Shabbos?
No, not Shabbos. It's on it's on, first of all, the regel, on the festival, on Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. If a person discovers tzaras on those days, I'm not talking about where they're already in the middle of the process, where it was discovered several weeks ago and now we're in the middle of it. But if it was discovered on those days, on Pesach, Shavuos, or Sukkos, the kohen does not rule. He waits until afterwards, and if it disappears by the time the kohen comes back, then it's like it never happened. It's not ruled upon at all. In addition, besides the regel, another example would be a chasan during his Sheva Brachas. A chasan from the time of his wedding, during his Sheva Brachas, if something appears that might be tzaras, either on his house, or on his clothing, or on his body, the kohen does not rule on it until the Shiva Yemei HaMishneh, until the 7 days of festivities are over. And we learn that from here, because you see there are days that are not impure, days that are pure, days that that the kohen cannot rule on tzaras, and it is left as if it's not there until the time is over. Now, if a person had saras and then the festival started, or then they got married, it would be hard to get married in that situation. But it would continue. Would not? It would not. There wouldn't be a grace period during the time of the regel or the marriage. It could happen with a marriage, let's say the person's home is afflicted, mm-hmm. and they want to get married, they can get married, but the home would still remain afflicted. It would not remove the problem from the house during that time.
And they wouldn't be able to go to the house.
Well, they could, but they become tummy. Right. Highly not recommended. Yes. Right. Okay, so that is the conclusion of the discussion of Tzaraas. Now, even though we are still in Parashas Metzora, the balance of the Parasha discusses other types of Tumah. And these are specific discharges that happen to either a man or a woman. And we need to have a little bit of an introduction in order to understand what is going to be happening over here. Now, the nature of the discussion from here on, and it's this entire chapter. Yeah, this chapter, chapter 15 in Parshas Metzora in Vayikra. The nature of the discussion here is going to be a little bit graphic. It does deal with discharges. Discharges means from the genitalia of a person, whether it's a man or a woman. The discharges are different in each. One of the things that will be discussed is nida, which will be the menstrual cycle of a woman. But in addition to that, we're going to have unnatural discharges, both for a man and for a woman. We are also going to discuss when a man and a woman are intimate, and the discharge that would come from a man in that situation, and how that would affect tuma and tara. So it is going to be a little bit more involved than we usually are, and as a result, I will probably end up translating less and resorting to the Hebrew more, just to keep the discussion on that level. Now, there are various types of tumah, and it is confusing for someone who is used to the laws of family purity. So gesund. For a person who is used to the laws of family purity and knows how they work, we will find that what the Torah describes does not line up with how we actually practice today. That is because the way we practice today, first of all, just like with Shabbos and with Kashrus and all other laws, there are rabbinic laws that are added on, just like any other law in the Torah. And here we're learning the rules according to the way the Torah says it without any rabbinic laws. So some of the things are going to be foreign to us. And in addition to that, there are elements of doubt that we have, that when we deal with family purity, because there are certain things that we don't know and we are unable to ascertain, so we have to be stringent in certain areas where we have to suspect that it might be this or that, and as a result, we're going to have to keep a little bit of a stricter guideline than what the Torah prescribes. So as we learn it in the Torah, we have to kind of try to ignore, at least temporarily, what we're used to and focus on what the Torah says, and then we can add in later the additional parts that are added because of how we practice today, because of the rabbinic rules and because of the doubt that we have about certain things. Now, the terminology that we need to be aware of in fact, I am going to use the board for this, so we have the terminologies down. We have for a man, so for a man we have Zav, and for a woman we have Zava. That makes sense? Yeah. Same word, Zav, Zava. The word Zav means flow. That's what the word means. It means flow. Same thing. It means flow. That's what the word means. But it is a category of tumah that will be described about a man and about a woman. In both cases, this is not a natural discharge. Both cases, both for the man and for the woman, it is an unnatural discharge. And it is a tumah. And we will see the rules for both Zav and Zava. In both cases, there will be a lower level and a higher level. Meaning there'll be a Zav that is only tummy for one day, then there'll be a Zav that is tummy for 7 days. there'll be a zava that is tamei only for one day. There'll be a zava that is tamei for 7 days. The zav and the zava, the one day, won't be so significant. The 7 day will actually be very significant. It's going to require counting clean days. It's going to require bringing a karban at the end. It's going to be a whole situation that no one really wants to get into. That is going to be zav and zava. Those are, again, unnatural discharges, both the lower level and higher level of each of those things. Then we have what we would call the natural tumos that come from a man or from a woman. For a man, the Torah is going to call it shichvas zera, which means seed. And for a woman, it's going to be called nida, which is a woman's menstrual cycle. So those are natural discharges from a man and from a woman. They will also bring with it certain types of tumah. Now, the as I said before, although we may be familiar with this one, with nida, as we will see in the Torah, it's not going to resemble what we're used to. For example, and this is probably the most startling thing that we will discover in the Torah, is that in the Torah, nida does not require clean days. Zava requires clean days if it's the, what they call Zava Gedola, it's the higher level Zava case, but nida does not require clean days. So, but anybody who is familiar with family purity knows that nida does require clean days. So, first we have to see what the Torah has to say, and then we can explain how it comes out that today we do keep clean days for that. But okay, that we'll see as we go along. Another important point with these different tumas is that obviously this one, shichva zera for a man, involves intimacy between a man and a woman, which means that although it is a discharge from the man, we also have to discuss what happens to the woman, since they are involved together when there is this discharge. So that's going to involve two people. In addition, what happens if a man and woman are intimate when a woman has one of these tumas? What happens to the man? So this is different than when two people, if I've been to a funeral, so that means I'm tamei mes, and then someone shakes my hand. So you can discuss, does that person become tamei or not? That's a discussion. But this is a little bit more specific and a little bit more, the Torah is going to talk about this in a more specific way, because since these tumas all originate from the genitalia, and that's how intimacy happens, as a result, there's going to be specific rules of contact between men and women, I'm talking intimate contact between men and women, when these tumas are at play. So that it's going to affect things. So as I said, this discussion is going to be a little bit graphic, and it's going to be because of the nature of the types of tumas we're talking about. In general, a little bit more of a... everybody have this? Because I'll erase it as soon as everybody has it. Okay, so I want to move on to a general talk about tumah now, so we can have another word of introduction. So... in general, the way tumah works is that there are four categories that can become tameh. We had this discussion before, but I want to apply it over here. There are four categories that can become tameh. Anybody want to give me a list over here?
Mace.
The mace is a source of tumah. Four things that can become tameh. Four categories.
House.
People is one.
House.
Food. Well, a house is not a category.
Oh,
food is one.
Clothing
is not a category.
Pottery.
Pottery is not a category.
Space.
No, not space.
Oh, okay.
Good. Utensils.
Oh, household goods.
Now, utensils includes clothing.
Right.
Pots and pans. It includes furniture. It includes jewelry. It includes utensils, is a lot of things. And finally, drinks. Food, drinks, utensils, and people can become tame. However, food and drink, at least I'm going to switch these because I want to keep them together. Food and drink are more susceptible to tumah than people and utensils. Which means as follows. Tumah usually follows a hierarchical system. Usually. Not always, but it usually does. So what happens is, you have the source of tumah. The source of tumah, then you come in contact with the source of tumah. So the source of tumah is called the, I'll put it over here, is called the Av. The Av HaTumah. Av means father. The father of tumah. Then it can, then let's say a person comes in contact with that source of tumah. So then it, okay, it brings it down to let's call it a person. This is going to be called Rishon. Rishon means
first
level. First level Tumah, this can be any category. Then, this Rishon comes in contact with something else.
Sheni?
So that's called a Sheni. It's a second. But a Sheni typically can only be food or drink. Typically, people and utensils cannot become a Sheni. Now I'm talking on a Torah level. I'm not talking on a rabbinic level. But typically speaking, that's as far as it goes. It goes, you have the highest level, which is the source of the tumah, can make any of these categories into a first level tumah, which can then make only these two categories into the second level tumah.
Oh.
Now this is a very simplistic presentation, but it's good enough for what we need to do. There are going to be exceptions and exceptions to the exceptions, etc.
So that's like if the bug flew into the food and then you ate it?
There is something like that. Okay. Hopefully you didn't eat the bug. Now, the source of tumah could be a dead cow that was not slaughtered. It just died. That's a tumah. That's an av hatumah. It's a father of tumah. And a person touches the dead cow, they become a rishon, and then they touch a loaf of bread, it becomes a sheni. Now, let's think about it for a minute. There's a dead cow, and I touch the dead cow. Dead cow is an av, that's the highest level. I become a rishon. It's the source. I become a rishon. I become first level tumah. What about my clothing? Clothing is utensil. So when I touch that cow, I become tumah. But my clothing remains tahar, remains pure. Because even though the clothing is touching me, and I touch the cow, but clothing typically cannot contract a second level tumah. So the clothing do not need to be put in the mikvah. Only I need to go to the mikvah, not the clothing. But if I touch a loaf of bread, that loaf of bread, you can't put a loaf of bread in the mikvah, but that loaf of bread is now tumah. So that's what I meant before when we learned about going into a house, etc., that if the person walks into the tzara's house and leaves right away, they become only a rishon, that's the first level tumah because the house is the av, and they become a rishon, and the clothing, which is touching the person, does not become tumah. However, if they linger in the house, and this is what's a little bit difficult to understand, if the person lingers in the house, then they become like an av hatuma. They become like an av hatuma, and their clothing becomes a rishon becomes a first level tumah. That's what it means. Yechabeses begadav. He needs to put his clothing into the mikvah. The Torah says if you linger in the house, you got to put your clothing in the mikvah because you now become kind of like the source of the tumah. There are going to be things like that. We're going to learn here with zav and zava as well. That there are certain things. If a person is a zav, and they shake hands with somebody, well, the zav is the source of tumah. They are the source of tumah. So, in theory, they should make that person into a rishon, into a first level tumah. Not only that, the zav's clothing should become tumah because they are the source of tumah. They have this discharge, they're the source of tumah. I want to make it clear. The discharge is not the tumah. This is a difficult thing to understand as well. It's not that the discharge is tumah and the person has touched the discharge. The act of having the discharge makes the person tumah. The person is a zav. They would be the source of tumah themselves. And then when they theoretically shake hands with somebody, that can make the other person tumah. But as we'll see, that's going to depend. The zav, zava, etc., it's going to depend. Sometimes they're going to be treated as an avat tumah. Sometimes they're going to be treated only as a rishon for tumah. And it'll affect whether or not their clothing has to be washed, meaning put in the mikvah, or not. So the tumah categories, the tumah levels, it depends on the type of tumah we're talking about and how many degrees of separation from the source of tumah. Now, a dead body, a dead person, is a higher level of tumah. It's called an avi avos tumah. It's the father of all fathers of tumah. So if a person comes in contact with a dead body, which is a mitzvah, a person is burying the body, a person is preparing the body for burial, whatever it is, a person comes in contact with a dead body, the dead body is not an avat tumah, it is an avi avos tumah. It's one level up from what we have on the board. So then a person prepares the body for burial, they become themselves an av hatumah.
Directly.
Okay. And their clothing becomes a rishon. Right. And therefore, if a person becomes tummy, they prepare a body for burial, then they go to shul on Shabbos, they shake somebody's hand, that person becomes tummy. Because the person who prepared the burial is an av hatumah, and they shake somebody's hand, that person is now a rishon. For us, that's perfectly fine. Right. That's the way life works. It's a mitzvah to take care of the dead. We're supposed to do it, right. And there's nothing wrong with it, and that's what's supposed to happen. Right. Even a kohen, it's okay for that thing to shake hands with somebody who prepared a body for burial. That's okay. The kohen cannot prepare the body for burial, but to shake hands with someone who did, okay. So they become, it's fine. Becoming tummy is a fact of life. That's the way life works. But it is important to know about it for the purpose of eating truma or going to the Beis HaMikdash. A person needs to know, has to be cognizant of the tumah and the tara. So when you think about it, if you ask, when Mashiach comes, so the how will that affect our lives as we deal with tumah and tara? You have to be aware of the fact that it affects our lives significantly to the point where when you come to shul on Shabbos, you can't just shake everybody's hand. For women, you can't just hug each other, because if the other person is an av hatumah and you shake their hand or give them a hug, you become tummy. Now you could. There's nothing wrong with becoming tummy, but you got to know about it. Right. You got to be aware of it, so that if I'm tummy and someone extends his hand, it's probably appropriate for me to tell him, by the way, I'm tummy. Right? You can still shake my hand if you want to, but be aware of it. Right? So it is a totally different way of living life that we take for granted. That, what do you mean? It's polite, it's appropriate. If someone extends their hand, you shake their hand. Somebody, right? That's just the way it is. But when you're living with tumah and tara, it doesn't work that way. When you're living with tumah and tara, what's considered to be a socially acceptable thing becomes different. It becomes not socially acceptable. There's a whole different way of living life with tumah and tara. And
we need to go to the mikvah all the time.
Well, not all the time. People are careful. That's what they do. It's just a whole different way of living. You remember, a lot of what we do today a lot of the social things that we do today are because we don't want to insult somebody, we don't want to put someone... But if everybody knows the rules, they don't get insulted. I mean, that's the rule, right? Today, you could be in an uncomfortable situation where a man extends their hand, and you have to decide, do I shake or do I not shake? What about it? They don't know any better, etc., 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 right? If everybody knows the rules, then no man extends their hand to a woman, and no one extends their hand to a man. It just doesn't happen, right? Because everybody knows the rules. So it's only because people don't know the rules that we end up in these awkward situations. Mm-hmm. So when Tumah and Tahara becomes the norm, as we hope it will speedily in our days, then everybody will know the rules. And then you don't have awkward situations because everybody knows these are the rules. You gotta play by the rules.
Does all of this apply only to relations between Jews?
So there are the specifics of Tumah and Tahara, Zav, etc., are only for Jews, not non-Jews. There are other Tumah rules for non-Jews, but not the ones we're going to learn in the next paragraph over here, the next chapter over here. Those are all specifically for Jews.
Yeah. I assume also when you're Menachem Ovil, sometimes, you know, you'll hug the person. Mm-hmm. Whatever. Same thing.
Right. That's right.
So what are you supposed to do? I mean, you can't ask somebody if you're so-and-so, if they don't even know what it means, and you don't want to hurt somebody's feelings. So does that mean you never hug what? Another person?
Why would you want to, today?
I mean, yeah.
Why not?
So this isn't applicable for today?
You know, you're tummy, that's all.
We're all tummy.
Yeah.
All the time.
All the time. Well, most of the time.
Okay.
We're tummy. Right. And it's okay.
Right.
It's okay to be tummy. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah, it's perfectly fine. And once Mashiach comes, the rules will be known. Mm. And then once the rules are known, then everybody understands it.
So when we go to the mikveh now, we're not tamei when we come out of the mikveh.
So when we go to the mikveh today,
right,
the mikveh removes certain types of tumah. It does not remove all types of tumah. So it does not remove the tumah of mace. If we went to a funeral, we remain tamei until the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt. Because we need the paraduma, we need the red heifer, which we'll learn about Mitzvah Hashem coming up in a few parshios. So we're just tamei, that's all. And there are other types of tumah which the mikvah that we use, the type of mikvah that we use, which is a mikvah that uses rainwater, which has been captured in an appropriate manner and placed in the ground, that will get rid of many types of tumah. It does not get rid of all types of tumah. We're going to actually see in the discussion of Zav and Zava, etc., that some of these tumahs are more powerful and they cannot be removed simply by the type of mikvah that we have. It actually requires an underground spring to get rid of the tumah that we're going to talk about over here. It's a more powerful tumah. But it doesn't affect us because, as far as we're concerned, the real issue that we go to the mikveh for is family purity, and that the type of mikveh that we have is very good for that. That's fine. That's perfectly fine. That works, and you don't need anything more than that. The fact that a person remains with the other tumas, that's okay. That's okay. When men go to the mikveh before Yom Kippur, before Rosh Hashanah, they're also only getting rid of a specific type of tumah. They're not getting rid of all the tumah that they have, because with the type of mikveh we have is inadequate for all the types of tumas that we have. It only works for some, not for others. But it gets rid of what they're trying to get rid of for Rosh Hashanah and for Yom Kippur. That's it, that it works for. So the as I said, life is gonna change in ways that we don't anticipate when Mashiach comes. There's a Tumah and Tahara is a whole, it's just a whole way of life that we are not familiar with that is going to play a role. Just to give you an insight, back in Parshas Vayera, when the angels come to Avram Avinu and they're posing as travelers, and Avram Avinu runs to greet them, and then he and Sarah prepare for the guests. So they prepare meat and they prepare cream. That's a whole discussion of milk and meat, and they prepare bread. So we also know that Sarah, who was at that time 89 years old, they predict that she is going to revert to being a young woman, and she'll be able to bear children. So the when Avram speaks to Sarah, he tells her to prepare bread or maybe matzah or something like that. Some sort of a
starch,
right. Good. Some sort of starch. But when he feeds them, he does not bring the bread. And the Gemara asks why. And the Gemara says because Sarah reverted back to being a young woman. Her cycle returned. She became tameh. And therefore the bread became tameh. Now there's nothing, the bread can be eaten. It doesn't make the bread unhealthy. But the bread became tameh. And Avraham, for his, was stringent not to eat bread that had become tameh. Now you'll say, then what did he do when his wife was tameh? And the answer is, that's a good question. That's a strong question. What did he do? It would make life fairly difficult. But that's the way Avram and Sarah chose to live their lives, was on that level of piety. That's an extra level of piety that he did. But there you have an example in the Chumash of a situation which, what do you mean? She's making bread. Like, well, you're gonna. And the answer is, well, it depends on the level that you're keeping. And Avram and Sarah kept a very high level. And that's the way they live their lives. So all the more so, you can be sure Avram didn't just shake hands with people. And he was dealing with people who didn't know any better. But he certainly did not just shake hands with people because that would make him tameh. He was very careful with these things. So even though it was before the Torah was given, but Avram Avinu and Sarah, they kept the Torah before the Torah was given. So this is just to show you the way life can be it's gonna change dramatically after Mashiach comes.
And we hope soon.
And we hope so, yes.
And until then, we're a mess.
Like a servant, Jewish or not, would it matter if she was menstruating or not, or if that would become tameh? So if somebody else made it, then he could eat it?
It depended on the situation. Again, if it was a non-Jew, it wouldn't have the same rules as with a Jew.
Right.
So yeah, that would change the thing. And they didn't throw the bread out. It was eaten, just not by Avram.
Right, but if somebody else made it, then could he eat it?
If it wasn't
his wife, you know.
Yeah, if it wasn't a case of tumah, which he was very careful with those laws of tumah. What is that?
A servant could have given it to the angels, the bread.
Well, he didn't want to serve them either. I don't know. That's a good question. Is why didn't he just serve them the tumah?
Well, it could be that serve them either.
Huh?
He did not serve them either.
He didn't serve the bread.
So why did he ever make it?
Why was it made?
It was made because before. She had her cycle back. What, in the process, that's when it happened.
Okay.
Good. Thank you.
So if it was made before, it would seem to me that it would be okay.
Yeah, if it was made before, okay. But it was during.
Oh, right.
And so that's the thing Mara says. Okay, so we will. That was the introduction. We'll continue this session next week. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.